Test 1, 2, 3. Tap.
You're mentioning John Chee Yamuzigar as one of the officials that you dealt with in the late 1950s. Was he influential or subways or?
In those days, he was contemporary in terms of age. He was up and coming. I think when I first met him, he was the deputy minister of health. And he just seemed to be intellectually compatible. Spoke a great deal about a wide range of things. He didn't have an awful lot of business to do with the Ministry of Health, and frankly, I can't even really remember my initial reason for approaching him, but in any event, we became very close official and personal friends. And of course, over the years, he became increasingly responsible in the government and when I left as Prime Minister, when I left the last time in 1978. Some of the other young technocrats that I met in the plan organization also became very close friends, personal friends. Reza Mogadam was one.
Pardon me?
Reza Mogadam. Odadad Parmatarmian, of course. Siru Sami. I'm trying to remember back then some of the people that I wish I had some of the invitations and guest lists that we had in those days. But virtually all of the members of the plan organization team, the Harvard group, all of those. There was a rare occasion, because of my level, that I would meet or have occasion to discuss anything with the ministers, which is not the case subsequently, but in those days. But one thing that I found of enormous benefit to me when I returned as the Deputy Chief of Mission in 1974 was that many of the friends that I had made back in the late 50s had continued on and into significant roles of responsibility, not only within the government, but in the private sector as well. I mean, there were bankers and lawyers and educators and just across the whole spectrum of society, which was of enormous benefit to me in terms of my own responsibilities. And I felt basically like I was coming back home in a certain sense. In other words, I didn't have to start from ground zero and gradually build acquaintances or confidences or anything else. And it got to the point where we would not infrequently find ourselves in unofficial but social gatherings where we were the only outsiders. And the Iranians accepted us just like another Iranian who was so well known, and vice versa, which was very comforting.
Now, in this earlier period, when you were meeting these people to begin with, did they ever give you sort of their candid views about how they felt about the Shah and his system? What kind of impression did they give you of their attitudes?
Oh. I would get some really quite frank discussions of the Shah and or government in general, even though in many cases they were part of the government. of the society, of the culture, of the way things were going. These were, once you gained the confidence, which I was lucky enough to do, they could be quite open. You have to understand the Iranian psychic and personality, and know that there are just certain things that you can talk about and other things you can't at a certain stage in your relationship. And it evolves. Back to your original question, yeah. There was criticism of the Shah, of his policies, of him personally, of the people around him. Some of them were really quite vehement. And some felt, you know, that really this was not the wave of the future. Something else had to be there. Now, they weren't talking over revolution, but more in idealistic or conceptual terms, that you know, if we're going to modernize and progress, we've got to have a different system than we've got right now. Too much power is centered in one man, and on and on. But as I say, there was never talk of, you know, let's land the barricades, that I heard.
In terms of the embassy's overall, like this is again in the late 50s, in terms of the embassy's overall role in Iran, did it have much contact with opposition figures like the National Front? Was there much discussion with these people or meetings, casual or planned? Or you recall?
Well, much is a difficult.
Yeah, or maybe any.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There was contact and discussion. Not in terms of U.S. government encouraging an alternative to the Shah. It was more in terms of being informed about what was going on and what people were thinking and what their attitudes were and where their loyalties were and that sort of thing. And it wasn't just the National Front. There was a variety of other peoples and little movements, philosophies. The one area that I would have to say we never really had much contact with was the religious side of life. And I suspect, even to this very day, that it probably would have been literally impossible to achieve this kind of rapport or understanding that we achieved with other factions in society. First we were Westerners, we had different outlook, different philosophy, different language, different almost everything. While I think we would have been pleased if this could have developed, it, I think, was evident to almost anybody that thought about it, unless we were an Islamic scholar where we had something really in common to discuss, and we were not Islamic scholars, representatives of the United States government. So that there wasn't any real grounds for discussion or contact.
To the extent that there the extent that there was contact with opposition type figures, National Front and otherwise, was this the Shah or his officials expressed opinions about this? Did they have any anxieties or worries about this kind of contact? Even just for informational purposes, did they just cause any problems or did you recall?
His government, or members of his government, evidently kept a fairly close watch on certainly some of the more prominent members of the opposition, and became aware, in one way or another, of contacts that they might have with non-Iranians, including members of the embassy. They let us know that they were aware of these contacts, one way or another. I don't think that I can remember any case where they expressed objection to it. They just let us know they were aware. Now, I suppose you could say, well, the implication was that by doing this, they were expressing dissatisfaction with the fact that these occurred. And to a certain extent, that's true. That's true. Nevertheless, they didn't, in effect, say, you're persona non grata if you persist in this, or anything like that. Because, again, in the Persian context, it is just sort of understood. You also had the other side of the coin, where I assume, and I have no direct evidence of this, but I assume that those people were also made aware of the fact that it was known that they had contacts with, among other people, representatives of the American government, the American embassy, and it might have been more explicit as far as they were concerned that this was not something to be encouraged. As I say, I have no direct evidence of this, but I don't think it's a misplaced assumption.
No, the people in the embassy were making comments. They're mostly political officers, basically, the political section of the embassy.
Well,
Or is it more broader than that?
It was broader than that. USIA had a lot of contacts with the academic community and the students and so forth, where you found a lot of dissidents. Our economic people had contact with business people and so forth, some of whom were not enamored with the way things were. Political section, again, politicians, opposition, active or semi-active opposition, and contacts with them, and they articulated their views, which were not necessarily in accordance with the regime. So there was a fairly broad spectrum of contacts in various parts of the society. It was not limited just government to government or anything like that. I mean, our presence was so massive.
Now, you said that at 59 you were in Stanford doing your MBA and MA in political science.
And economics.
And that was 59 to 60?
Yeah.
And you went back to State Department?
Yeah.
As the working for the country?
Desk officer.
What was your actual position there?
Well, there was the head of the Iranian desk office, and there were two of us, one myself, economic officer, and one a political officer. and then the support staff and a couple of secretaries.
Now, who was the death director at this point, the country director at this point?
John Bowling.
John Bowling. Mm-hmm. Okay. And who was the political person that you worked with?
It's terrible.
Maybe it might come up later on or something.
Yeah, I honestly can't remember offhand. There's John so dominated the political side of things, and he was very knowledgeable, as I mentioned earlier. I honestly can't remember him doing political things.
Was Bowling at the embassy in the late 50s also? Before
John and I were together in the, I mean, we were there at the same time.
What was his position in the embassy at that time?
He was first secretary.
The first secretary?
In the political section.
Okay. Then he went to the country desk?
Right.
61 or 60?
John was there when I got there, so he must have come there in 60, earlier than, early 60.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you mostly monitored economic affairs when you were working for these 3 years, I guess, for 63?
Right.
Okay. Now, one development early in the Kennedy administration, only under Kennedy, was the formation of a task force on Iran. Were you involved in that, in the task force?
Yes.
Do you recall what precipitated its formation, what led Kennedy and Rusk and so forth to decide to set this up and have it do a review of policy?
I'm not sure I remember precisely the reason for it. It may have been a configuration of concerns in the new administration about Iran, about stability of the country, the direction it was going. Its dependency on the United States, its request for assistance. And I suppose a perception in, among some members of the new administration that things indeed were going to pot and that something had to be done to retrieve the situation. Maybe even that was the basic reason of what factors entered into that perception. I'm not really sure, but I think that was fairly clear that there was that perception in the White House. In any event, there was this mandate that came down to form a task force and come up with a solution. And there was a great first, because it was a new administration, everybody wanted to get in the act. So there were people from the Department of Agriculture and Treasury and I don't know, it was the most ridiculous. Everybody had to get in. So you call a task force meeting and you get 60 or 70 people, you know, to try and hammer out the meaningful and hopefully effective policy toward Iran. Well, as is so often the case, situations like that have boiled down to John Bowling and I, and ultimately Phil Talbot writing a paper. I don't know if you've come across this for research.
Some of it.
But there was a paper produced, which was then passed on to the White House and National Security Bundy, if I remember correctly, I think I do, which was then, okay, this is going to be our policy for Iran. If I remember correctly, the difference between, if there was a difference, what the U.S. government's policy toward Iran was before that, and what it was the Kennedy administration was mainly on the economic side, mainly to do with economic reform. To some extent dealing with the military aspects, but again, the broad policy objectives were the obvious ones, you know, national integrity, independence of the country, economic development, social welfare, you know, flag and mom and apple pie.
Well, so the thrust of the approach taken by the task force to uphold those kinds of objectives.
The thrust of any administration toward any country.
Yeah.
Not unique to Iran.
But, as you said a minute ago, there was some interest in economic reform. Those
yeah, I mean, more emphasis, shall I say, on that aspect of it. A more hard-nosed, if you will, attitude toward, now look, you've really got to get down to cases here and do something about corruption, endemic corruption, about the bureaucracy, about budgeting your resources, about establishing priorities, etc.
And the land reform,
maybe part of
that, land reform a major part of that thrust of that? Or no?
Well, if I remember correctly, land reform was already something that had been initiated by Shah. But I think that an element of this plan, if you call it that, was an emphasis on pursuit of land reform, yes. Which was not in conflict with Shah's own objectives. Not at all. As a matter of fact, I think that he saw this as a key element of his own approach to modernization, as well as political power. But so I don't think that he needed an awful lot of that. Here, again, my memory's a little weak, but it wasn't so much the objective, it may have been means toward the objective that we maybe in some discontinuity about.
The country task force, do they assess or review security policy or political policy generally?
Yeah, everything. Everything.
Did anything new come out of that at that end of things, or do you recall?
Well, there was quite vigorous debate about the military side of it and our relationship and role in Iran's military buildup, with one faction feeling very strongly that there had been too much emphasis in the past on that aspect of Iranian life, and that we ought to cut back severely.
A military aid, for example.
Military aid. Yeah.
Who were the proponents of that? Do you recall? Who? Like AID or who might have pushed that?
Well, AID, yes, to some extent. I don't recall that aid was terribly vociferous on this side. But yes, they just philosophically would and did want to emphasize the economic side much more than the military side, so that's the camp, if you would, the for and against side. They would be on the against the military side. Ken Hansen, who was with the Harvard Group, as I mentioned earlier, and I guess through Gene Mason or somebody, anyhow, Ken ended up as, in the new administration, came back, joined the new administration as the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury for International Affairs. And he had a very strong bias towards the plan organization against the military. So he was a strong voice in that. Bob Comer, not too many years ago, was Deputy Secretary of the Defense Policy Planning or something. I'm not sure exactly the title, but a very high position in the Defense Department. Anyhow, Bob was in the White House on the NSC in those days. And he was a very vigorous opponent of military assistance and State Department in general. So those were some of the key players on the one side of the question.
Well, in terms of the task force recommendations, they talk about a special emphasis on court reform, pushing the Shah to take a more restrained approach towards his power, pushing for the more constitutional role for the Shah. Was there discussion of that end of things?
And certainly there was some discussion of it in the paper. And the paper itself was the kind of paper that you would recognized as a product of the bureaucratic system where there was on the one hand and on the other hand kind of thing. I honestly can't recall what specific recommendation was made in that area. I'm certain there was something that was said. And it had to be in the direction of more participation, broadening the access to the political system, etc. But I think more importantly, the question is whether these recommendations, and again, I don't remember the precise specifics of it, were acted on. Now, or even accepted by the White House. Generally, there was, as I remember, dissatisfaction in the White House with the recommendations. And there was a fair amount of debate back and forth.
Between Bundy and the State Department, for example?
Between State and the NSC, and Bundy, yes, but just the NSC and Bob and Ken and so forth. So that you didn't get a crisp, sharp, specifically articulated 1, 2, 3, this is what we're going to do and go do it kind of thing. You've got more of, well, in general, this is the direction we want to go, and yes, we'll do this on the military side, like sell them a frigate, or we won't sell them that, or yes, the level of aid this year will be this if they do that, and on down the line. This is my recollection.
Did you get a sense of where President Kennedy stood on Iran generally, or the Shah, or what he thought should be?
Well, it's interesting. It was interesting. As I said, my perception was that he and the Shah didn't like each other at all.
What gave you that impression?
various comments that I've heard, various sources, including, I think, a public comment, or at least one that became known, as he called it a tin pot dictator. That wasn't necessarily well received in Tehran. Apparently, the personal animosity before President, or Kennedy, whoever, President, grew out of some kind of macho lady conflict. I say apparently, I have no direct knowledge of this.
It was alleged.
It was a story. In any event, you've got a very strong sense one way or another in the White House that there's no great love affair. But I must say this for Jack Kennedy, that he came to understand far faster than most of his advisors that the world was much more complex than they were suggesting to him, and that things were much more difficult, and solutions were much harder to find than might have appeared to be the case. And I was gratified at one stage in my life and the service of government that I think it was a speech he made Seattle or something like that, where he said publicly, in effect, let's face it, American citizens, we don't have all the answers. And I thought, well, thank God the President of the United States realizes that that is the case, because we often pretended like indeed we did have all the answers. Anyhow, while there was a lot of rhetoric at that time and a lot of toing and froing, in the end, what we ended up with, in my view, was a fairly pragmatic policy. While they said, you know, we ought to have a plan for the next 5 or 10 years, in fact, what we were doing and what we end up generally doing whatever we do, is sort of on a day-to-day basis. We have broad general goals, but the specifics and the details, we're, you know, we'll deal with it as we go along, and that's what we did.
At the same time, the task force was doing its planning and thinking. In the spring of 61, the Shah appointed a liberal as Prime Minister, Ali Amini. Since that appointment was made, in the course of the years, it's been alleged that the Shah made that appointment under American pressure from the State Department or the White House, one way or the other. Did you get that sense at the time, that there was some pressure to appoint a new Prime Minister, a more reformer, more reformist-type politician to
Well, I know there was, I know that that is a familiar story, and I wouldn't argue that at one level or another, and in various forms or another, there was an argument that being made by the American government that he ought to appoint a liberal, forward-looking statesman as his prime minister. That Amini's name was ever specifically suggested, I doubt. Although it might have been sort of an illustrious list of people who had impressed us as people that might serve the Shah well in his in implementing and forwarding his own program, and it would be put in those terms, I think. If we ever said anything on the subject, would be like that. but that we, that he was appointed prime minister under duress and at the behest of the American government, I do not believe at all. And having observed how we operate in foreign affairs, at least in that part of the world, over many, many years, I just do not believe it.
That's interesting, though. The Shah in the late 50s said on a Newsweek interview that he, in fact, said that that was the case that he'd been.
I know.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. And I can't deny that, you know, he may have gotten that impression one way or another. From whomever. But I think that that's a distortion of what really happened.
Well, I have the impression that Kennedy got to know him, you know, during the 50s. I mean, he was ambassador to Washington, apparently, in the mid-50s.
Who?
Ali Amini.
Yes.
I guess Kennedy got to know him.
He spoke that sort of, liberal language.
Uh-huh.
Which he wasn't at all, actually. He was very much an autocrat in the cast of the Shah, if not more so. Maybe even Reza Shah. He was, and I don't mean to denigrate him, he was a perfectly honorable man, but he was a true Persian in that sense, from an aristocrat family, wealthy landowning family and so forth. And that was his background, and that's the way he acted and thought. When he talked with the Western world, why, he could, you know, use the language and rhetoric of the Western liberal. But in practice, he was just as autocratic as any of them.
Well, you mentioned earlier one of your activities, the department was working with the IMF deportation program, working on that issue. And you mentioned the task force. What else were you involved in during this period, 60 to 63, in the country? That's one of the major issues that came up. If you can,
well, nothing particularly stands out in mind. It was sort of the ongoing day-to-day business of grinding bureaucracy, fighting bureaucratic battles on this front or that front, trying to get aid levels, at whatever they were, servicing the embassy and the ambassador in the sense of providing them with information about what was going on in Washington, being sure that their thoughts and recommendations were funneled into the decision-making process, that they got to the notice of the right people. One specific issue I was wrestling with was a claim by our government against the government of Iran for lend-lease debt. We felt that Iran owed us, I forget the exact sum of money, X million dollars, and we were determined to collect it. This was for equipment, mainly military equipment, that was left over, basically left over in Iran after World War II, and we given to Iran, but we put a price tag on it, you know, sort of in effect, we said, well, this is a loan, and it's time for you to repay this loan, the value of this equipment. Well, I really don't want to bore you because it is in a way boring, but all of the ramifications of this and how it impacted on our aid program, should we take it out of the aid, and dealing with the Iranians on this and saying, you know, pay up your bill, and
did they finally settle on terms that were
considered? And I thought when I left Iranian affairs in 63, that I'd seen the last of that problem. Not true. When I came back and become country director in 1969, the problem was still there. When I went to Iran as DCM in 1974, the problem was still there. And when I left Iran in 1978, the problem was still there. And I, on occasion, had to make a démarche to, when I was either chargé or DCM in the 70s, to the Iranian government about this issue, which by then was niggling compared to all of the other things that we had going. And I vividly recall one occasion where I went in to see the Minister of Finance, Hushang Ansari.
Name again, please?
Hushang Ansari.
Okay.
And made representation about the outstanding debt that we wanted paid. And it was a fairly tough message, toughly worded. And I didn't really like it myself, and I knew it wasn't going to go over well at all with Hushang Ansari or any other Iranian, for that matter, that you heard it. But I did my duty, and Hushang was also a good friend of mine, but we were dealing as official, and he rather coldly told me, well, he heard my message. They did not accept our basic premise, and that nevertheless they would study the matter.
So they did. Well, one issue that came up in 52, apparently, I recall, was there was a new approach taken through the military aid, whereby the U.S. would tie military assistance and economic aid generally, to efforts by the Shah to cut back on the size of his army, to keep it to a certain level, like 100,000 men. Do you recall? Were you involved in formulating that approach, or implementing it in one way or the other? Apparently it went up to the NSC level, it was discussed by the NSC in spring of 62.
I certainly was not involved in deciding that a numerical limitation ought to be placed on the size of the military force. I obviously was made aware of it, and participated in implementing the policy, and to the extent that I discussed this with whoever I was in contact with. And the approach also evolved, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the precise chronology here, but in our getting involved in depth in a budgeting process, if you will, whereby our aid program was, and the size of our aid, the amount of our aid, was both military and economic, was part of a larger judgment about the overall economy and plan organization budget and so on. So, and that this was supposed to be a logical element in Iran's overall program of military and economic development, and that we would, when they would tell us what they wanted to do, we would make a judgment about what our aid ought to be. And this held true to a greater or lesser extent until about 1971 or 72. This was a fairly long-term program. And posture that we put vis-a-vis our economic and military system to
putting credits as well as grants? Putting credits as well as grants?
Yeah. And a very intimate association with the whole process, obviously, if you're in a country's budgeting process.
Now, did you, when you were helping implement this program, did you work closely with Iranian officials at the embassy that were involved in these same things? Did you meet with them?
The Iranian embassy had little or nothing to do with it. No, our business was through our embassy and to our embassy with the appropriate elements of the Iranian government in Tehran. We did little or no business, serious business, with the Iranian embassy in Washington. There were one or two people that I vaguely remember that really were in a position to do any business for that matter. Ardashir Zahedi, son-in-law of the Shah, was ambassador then, and he was subsequently.
In the early 60s?
Hmm?
In the early 60s?
In the early 60s.
And he came back later on?
And he came back later on. He was ambassador twice. Foreign minister, and then came back as ambassador. And I discussed some business with Ardashir, but really not very much. The really, really serious business was not with the embassy in Washington, it was through our embassy. Yeah.
Now, in terms of, you're saying there's a very close U.S. scrutiny of any expenditures on military equipment and so forth under this program, how did the Shah